The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. It is Wednesday, January 16th. On our agenda today is Senate File 1, Senator Lori's bill. We're going to start out by welcoming the director of the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange Board. No, committee? Council. What is it?
Exchange,
period. April Todd Malmlove, who's the executive director, and we have Commissioner Showalter with us. Welcome. Members, I've asked Ms. Todd Malmlove to do an overview for us because I love the job she did in Commerce just a few hours ago. But she is going to go rather quickly over the Commerce sections and focus more on the sections that are relevant to us and talk more about those because we are restricted today in dealing with only the sections that are under our jurisdiction, which is, I think I even wrote down those areas, are the board establishment, Office of the Legislative Auditor, what do they do? Office of the Legislative Auditor, governance and responsibilities of the board. Those are basically what are.
So the sunset.
Also the sunset and the exemption from rulemaking are under our jurisdiction. Welcome to the committee. Oh, before we start, I did want to welcome Senator Dan Hall, who is minority lead on the committee, and we're sorry we missed you. I understand you had to be out of town.
I did. But, nice to be back and jump right into this one.
And you want to say a little bit about your district?
Well, my district is Burnsville, Savage, and Lakeville. Changed a little bit. I lost Bloomington. I live in Burnsville. I guess that's about it. We're glad to be a part of this.
All right, thanks. Well,
thank
welcome.
You.
Okay, Commissioner, are you beginning?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. The mic seems to be extraordinarily loud here at this space, too. So
no, it sounds fine.
Is it fine? Okay, good. With me is April Todd Malmlove, and she's the Executive Director of the Health Insurance Exchange. It is a small group of people who've been working for the last couple of years to develop a Minnesota response to the federal ACA, which significantly changes the marketplace for health insurance. And the insurance exchange is one small part of that overarching piece of legislation, but it's a very important one for Minnesota, and from my estimation, it's one of the most important things that's before the legislature this session. It is also on a very fast track. The reason is because the federal government has given us a relatively limited timeline to respond to the requirements and gives us a choice of whether we're going to do a Minnesota model and set up a state-based health insurance exchange or whether we're going to take a partnership exchange or go and just say, federal government, you go ahead and do it. We have opted and are pursuing a state-based exchange, and April will talk about some of the reasons, but really I just want to highlight and underscore a couple of them, which is state control. You know, we have an opportunity to really continue and further the state insurance market that we have here already. We're already fairly unique. And by going into a federal-based exchange, we would lose the opportunity to really control some of the regulatory and industry elements that make Minnesota a special place. What's more is I think on costs, I think we can make improvements and changes that the federal government cannot do that will make this a better place, a better buy for the insurance marketplace, and really will further the public and private sector marketplaces for insurance. So it's a very important piece of legislation, but it's also a very complex one and far-reaching. And so it's great that you're having April give you this presentation again before you hear Senate File 1. It'll put it into context. Hopefully address some of the questions that you might have about the bill itself. Again, the reason that we are really on a fairly fast track is because the federal government needs, by the end of March, a response from Minnesota as to whether we're going to be able to have the authorizing language in place for that state-based exchange. We intend to get there, but really that's ultimately the question of the legislature right now, of whether this legislation can be reviewed, perfected, and set forward. And we appreciate Senator Lori and his leadership on this issue, and this is the first stop, so we're very excited about it. With that, I will turn it over to April to walk through sort of the background of what the health exchange is all about.
All right. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Ms. Todd Malmlove, I'm gonna struggle over your name until I get used to it. Malmlove.
Malmlove.
Malmlove. Okay.
It should have an E at the end, but
All right. Why don't you begin?
So, again, I'm April Todd Momlove, Executive Director of the Exchange. Madam Chair, as you asked, we're going to go through this fairly quickly and really focus on the things more germane to this committee and not cover so much the other areas. But generally, this presentation, want to cover just what an exchange is, what the goals of it are, the components. And, again, I'll go over the component pieces fairly quickly. Talk about what's been done to date. As Commissioner Showalter referenced, we have been working on this for about 2 years. What's next? What's upcoming? And then some key issues. I'll focus on some of the governance key issues and what other states are doing around governance as well. So what is an exchange? An exchange is a new marketplace where Minnesotans can find, compare, choose, and get quality healthcare coverage that best fits their needs and their budget for their family. And it starts in 2014. So coverage starts on January 1st of 2014. Open enrollment to choose that coverage starts October 1st of 2013. And so what are the goals of the exchange? I'd say the first one is really to promote the triple aim. And so the first one is, really to get at health improvement. And so to create incentives for enhanced quality, enhanced satisfaction, to really give people the incentives and give carriers the incentives to work with people to improve their health. Also to improve the consumer experience. I think we all know that healthcare is really complex. It's hard for people to navigate. And so the exchange is there to make things simple for people, give them the information that they need to make good choices. Third is affordability, making coverage more affordable for people. And this really happens in two ways. One is, really encouraging competition on value, on affordability, quality, on those areas to really drive prices down in the long term. But also, the exchange is the place and the only place where people can get access to premium tax credits, both individuals and small businesses, towards the purchase of coverage. So it makes it more affordable to them.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, do you want us asking questions now or waiting till the end?
I think you should wait to the end because I think your question could be answered in the presentation.
Thank you.
All right.
I'll go over this slide really quickly. This is more of a commerce aspect of kind of increasing competition where, really the healthcare market doesn't operate like a market. And the reason for that is that there just is a lack of information, a lack of understandable information, and consumers really aren't engaged in these choices. Employers often make these choices and really just kind of a lack of choice. And so the exchange is there to provide information and enhanced choice for people. So again, to advance the triple aim and enhance market competition, it creates a one-stop shop, it streamlines access to public and private coverage, provides financial assistance for individuals to help them afford coverage, and promotes quality and improved health outcomes through competition on value. Also creates transparent apples-to-apples comparison information so people can easily compare and make choices, fosters market competition on value and affordability. And in making things simpler and providing people with information, it really engages consumers in making well-informed decisions, gives them choice, and reduces barriers to entry for newer and small insurers by making the administrative aspect of getting into this field easier. So in terms of participation, what we did, one of the first things that we did when we started on this project was we engaged Dr. Jonathan Gruber of MIT and Bella Gorman, who's an actuary, on doing some economic and actuarial modeling for us to determine what the impact of the exchange would be on Minnesota. So how many people would be impacted by the exchange? And so the most recent numbers that we have as of last week, updated numbers, is that the exchange really will serve 1.3 million Minnesotans. That's roughly 25% of our population. And that can be broken down into three groups. The first one is individual consumers, 450,000 individual consumers. Of those 450,000, 370,000 of those are eligible for premium assistance tax credits to help them afford coverage. Also will help serve small businesses and their employees. That's roughly 160,000. Of those 160,000, a little over 30,000 of those would be eligible for small business tax credits to help them afford coverage. And then the last group is medical assistance enrollees at roughly 700,000 individuals. And this is, non-elderly, non-disabled individuals. And really the exchange under the ACA is required to provide streamlined eligibility enrollment both for public programs and for private coverage. So it covers really both the private and the public side. So eligibility. So who is eligible? Just getting a few more details here on who's eligible. First, for individuals. So the individual market, generally, anyone purchasing coverage on their own is eligible to participate in the exchange. Some of those individuals, actually most of those individuals, will be eligible for tax credits to help make coverage more affordable for them. And this is for individuals between 138 and 400% of the federal poverty level. As a frame of reference, 400% of the poverty level for a family of four is about $90,000. So this assistance that people will get, it's a sliding scale where it will limit premiums to between 2 and 9.5% of someone's income for that coverage. And people eligible for those tax credits are individuals not eligible for affordable employer coverage. The definition of affordable is individuals, if they work for an employer, if their contribution towards that employer-based coverage is more than 9.5% of their income, they're eligible to participate in the exchange and get a tax credit. So the third group of individuals eligible to participate in the exchange are those eligible for Medicaid. And so those are individuals below 138% of the federal poverty level. There's also another option that I won't go over today that the state has that is a basic health plan or some other type of premium assistance for individuals between 138 and 200% of the federal poverty level. That is a state option. We are still awaiting guidance on what that option could do for Minnesota. The second group are small groups. So small groups in 2016 will be defined as 100 employees or less. Prior to 2016, the state can either have the exchange serve small groups size 50 or less or put it up to 100. They have that choice. So for 2 years, it could be at 50 or less. But in 2016, under the ACA, the definition of small group will be 100 employees and under. Some of those small employers will be eligible for tax credits for up to 2 years. It could cover up to 50% of the employer's premium portion. And this is for employers that have 25 employees or less and an average wage of $50,000 or less. Another group is large group. And large groups may be allowed to participate in the exchange starting in 2017. This is at a state's discretion. So I'm just going to talk briefly about the functions, so what it is that the exchange is required to do under the law. The first requirement is that it needs to provide a one-stop shop, including a call center and a website for people to find information and get assistance in choosing coverage. It also needs to ensure that health insurance plans meet certain standards. It needs to provide comparative information on health benefit plans, costs, quality, satisfaction using a standardized format. Also needs to provide assistance online, by phone, by mail, and by fax. Needs to determine or needs to facilitate real-time eligibility and enrollment. And what we mean by real-time is that today when you're applying for insurance, it may take a few weeks to determine if you're eligible or not, given underwriting and how public program eligibility works today. Real time literally means within a half hour to an hour going through the process, you'll know if you'll be enrolled in a product once you pay that premium or are determined eligible. It also needs to determine eligibility for individual and employer tax credits, Medicaid, and coverage requirement exemptions or the individual mandate if people are eligible for exemptions from that. It needs to process appeals for determination. So if an individual thinks that they were wrongly determined ineligible for tax credits or medical assistance, they're able to appeal that determination, and the exchange needs to process that. The exchange also needs to establish a navigator program. And a navigator program is essentially individuals or organizations that can help individuals navigate through their healthcare coverage options and help them enroll in coverage. For small employers, there are some additional functions. It needs to facilitate employee choice and premium aggregation. And what employee choice means is that today, most small employers offer one plan to their employees, and all the employees are enrolled in one plan. What the exchange allows is something called defined contribution, which essentially means that the employer can put a certain amount of money towards the coverage of their employees, and the employee can pick from multiple carriers and multiple health plans, whatever they feel is most appropriate for their situation. Lastly, the exchange must comply with numerous federal oversight, auditing, and reporting provisions. This is just a graphic. I'm not going to go over this in detail. This just kind of is a graphic of all of the different functions that the exchange needs to perform and the entities that it will interact with. Some of these later rules, I'll probably skip over these. These few slides are really describing some of the market rules that apply broadly both inside and outside the exchange. And those are things related to benefit rules. So there's a minimum essential benefit that all plans need to offer inside and outside the exchange. There's also rating rules. So premiums can't be determined based on health status anymore. Rating variation is limited to tobacco use, age, geography, and family composition. There's also guarantee issue. What that means is that people that apply for coverage can't be denied. They have to be accepted. And open enrollment applies inside and outside the exchange in the same way. So essentially, this slide is just highlighting all of the new rules coming under the ACA that apply both inside and outside the exchange in the same way. This next slide highlights some of what you could call market rules that apply under the ACA that the exchange is required to comply with in addition to the market rules that apply market-wide. So the exchange needs to make sure that plans are complying with marketing standards. And what that means is that plans that participate in the exchange cannot have discriminatory marketing. So they can't market differently, for example, to people that are healthy versus those that are sick. The plans that participate in the exchange also need to comply with network adequacy requirements. The one thing I forgot to mention is that many of these standards that are listed here under law and regulation, they aren't specified what those provisions are. That's left up to the states or to a board to determine the details of what those requirements are. So, for example, under network adequacy, what that means is that plans that participate in the exchange need to have certain healthcare providers in their network. The law doesn't specify what healthcare providers or how close they need to be, just that there needs to be a standard that the plans need to comply with. Plans on the exchange also need to be accredited by a quality organization. So that's NCQA, the national NCQA or URAC, those organizations that do quality accreditation. Exchange plans also need to disclose information. And that type of information really is they need to disclose information on their claims payment policies and denials, their level of enrollment and disenrollment, company financial information, medical loss ratios, those types of things they have to disclose to consumers. They also, the exchange plans on the exchange also have to implement a quality improvement strategy. They have to use a standardized format, again, for comparing plan options around benefits and costs, quality, and customer satisfaction. They need to utilize a uniform enrollment form and process, need to offer at least one silver and one gold plan. And again, what silver and gold means is that it's a different level of cost sharing, essentially, for consumers. There are five different levels that are there, and it needs to offer the two middle levels of cost sharing levels to consumers. And those, I think, are the main things that are different on plan certification, I think, of importance to this group. I think I'm going to skip over this slide. This really gets into some of the risk-sharing provisions, I think, of more relevance to commerce. Next slide, go over this a little bit more around some of the operational components. So there are some governance options that exist for states. Essentially, there are three categories. A state can have a state-based exchange, or it can have a quasi-public-private entity, or a private nonprofit established
by
the state.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, 1 second. Can they straighten that out on the board so we can read it? It's cut off.
And did you get a handout too, Senator Goodwin?
Yeah, okay. But the other people can't see it.
Oh, let me see. I wonder if I can
stay.
That's funny. I don't know. I guess look at your handout.
Oh, well.
Technical difficulties. Not quite sure why that's showing up.
I probably went to get more chairs or something.
Okay. Miss Emily here.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I think that's why I'm the commissioner, not the CIO.
Yeah. Why don't you proceed?
So as I was mentioning, there are three options for governance. Either the state does their own exchange, they can do a partnership with the federal government, or the federal government, or they're in the federally facilitated exchange. Under a state-based option, there's three options. It can be a state agency, governed by a state agency. It can be a quasi-public-private entity or a private nonprofit. under financing, the exchange can be financed with federal funds for development through the end of 2013 and for the first year of operation in 2014. Starting in 2015, the exchange has to be self-sustaining with its own financing source. One exemption to this for the 2014 financing from the federal government is that funding for navigators is not allowed under federal grants, but could be available for an in-person assister program that we'll talk about a little later. So as Commissioner Showalter mentioned earlier, you know, we have decided to move forward with a state-based exchange. And there really are a variety of reasons for doing that. Some of the things considered or some of the reasons for doing a state-based exchange versus a federal is, you know, really that Minnesota is very unique. We are viewed as one of the leaders in the country on healthcare, bringing high value to our consumers, lower cost. And, you know, we have a long history of public and private healthcare reforms in this state. We were one of, and I think the first state to have a high-risk pool back in the 70s with MSHA. Also one of the first states to have a low-income subsidy program through Minnesota Care. Really have a long history of doing that. Also, we have a very strong regulatory environment. And I think what you'll see here is many of the reforms in the ACA, the market reforms, already existed in Minnesota. And so we didn't have to make as many changes as many other states did with the enactment of the ACA. And also, we have been nation leading in bipartisan reforms to improve value. And so really, it's maintaining the ability to do health reform in this state and to do it in the stellar way that we have done it for many decades. Second reason is around plan management. And again, this is the ability to control what the certification requirements and process are. Again, this is kind of tied to the very strong regulatory environment that we've had in the state and maintaining that here in the state versus the federal level. On customer service, also maintaining that here in the state. One of the things I'll quote, one of the things that Representative Davids, I think, mentioned in the press conference last week, that important to make sure that people can call a 651 or a 218 number instead of a 202 number to get help. Also having a navigator and broker program established in the state, being able to have control over that rather than give that up to the federal government. On financing, also, one of the things that Commissioner Showalter had referenced earlier is the federal government is going to be assessing a 3.5% premium withhold to fund the operations of the exchange. We have our estimates on our budget are less than that 3.5%, so I think that we can do this much more cost effectively than the federal government. Also, Minnesota is known for and very much leads the nation in having comparison data. So data on cost and quality and customer satisfaction. We have a long history here of both the public and private sectors working together very collaboratively to develop information for consumers that can help them make good choices. This level of information just does not exist at the federal level, and so that would be really lacking if that was not available for Minnesotans to use. And then lastly, on Medicaid interactions, this really provides us an opportunity to upgrade some very aging systems in Minnesota. Our Medicaid eligibility system is over 20 years old, will cost multi-millions of dollars to upgrade. So this really provides us a way to cost-effectively do upgrade both Medicaid eligibility systems and the exchange at the same time. So I want to talk a bit about the blueprint. So as I mentioned, we made the decision to move forward on a state-based exchange. And in doing that, that required us to submit to what's called a blueprint to the federal government. The blueprint is the application to the federal government where we had to prove to them that we had done enough work to be able to have an exchange operational by open enrollment on October 1st of 2013.
Okay. And Ms. Palmlove, remember you're doing a more short presentation.
Yep. And I'm not going to go over these application components because they're very detailed. But do want to just mention that we submitted that in October. We were conditionally approved in December. We are one of 18 states that were conditionally approved. Conditional approval means that we have an agreement negotiated with HHS that specifies conditions for future approval. One of those conditions is that we have legislation by the end of March. To make sure that we stay on timeline with those milestones. I'll skip over this slide.
Must be something wrong with the projector.
Just talk a bit about, so we have received a variety of funding. We have received $71 million in funding to date, have requested $110 million. We hope to hear about that by the end of this month to help us really do a lot of the work, the development work that is needed on the exchange. And that, you know, that funding has helped us do a lot of things. One, we established an advisory task force in November of 2011. That advisory task force has advised on the design and development of an exchange and has really included a balance of interests, including consumers and employers, labor, healthcare providers, insurers, those with expertise in public and private programs, agents and brokers, really tried to engage everyone in getting feedback on the design and development. And also engaged over 200 Minnesotans in working in some very technical work groups to help us in many of the areas that really need to get knee-deep in the weeds around adverse selection and measurement and reporting, navigators, outreach and communications, those types of things. This slide is just to show that building the exchange is a very complex effort. It's not just a $110 million website. There's a lot of work going on behind the scenes here to get this work done. So this is just explaining some of the complex work occurring to get the exchange up and running. Let's see here. So I want to focus a little bit on ongoing or next steps. So as I mentioned, one of our conditions to receive full approval to operate an exchange on October 1st of 2013 is to make sure that we have legislation by the end of March. That legislation needs to at least include these four areas around governance, financing, kind of the process for planned participation and the certification process. It needs to address customer service, navigators and brokers. Some of the smaller issues that also needs to be addressed is I'd also put appeals on that list as well, kind of the process for doing that. What we will also have just upcoming and ongoing is a lot of the business operations to get this up and running, a lot of the technology work that needs to occur. And on outreach and marketing, we're really starting to get to what this thing is going to be called. Everyone hates the word exchange and the word marketplace. So we hope by February to really have a name and a brand that people can relate to, and then really starting to message out to the public of what the exchange is, what the benefits are, and get people ready and excited for open enrollment on October 1st. So some of the key issues, and I'll focus mostly here on governance, unless the committee would like to hear more about those other areas. So on governance, wanted to look a bit at what other states have done. We often get questions about what are other states doing in this area. So as I mentioned previously, there are 18 states that have been approved, conditionally approved to do a state-based exchange. Of those 18 states, 10 have legislation, 4 have executive orders, and 4 of them don't have legislation or executive orders yet that cover all of the component pieces. 6 of the states are doing a partnership exchange, and the rest will be in the federal exchange in 2014. So on governance, just a few considerations here. And these considerations come from some of the work of the governance work group that was working with the Exchange Advisory Task Force. So really looking at the type, whether it's a state entity, a public-private entity, or a nonprofit, the governance work group really looked at both the public and private sides that of the exchange, how it needs to help public programs and also work with the individual and small group markets, that really a public-private partnership was the best structure for that governance. Also looked at board structure in terms of size, compensation, what the terms are, the appointing authority, and conflict of interest provisions. And then the task force and the governance work group in particular really recommended a few principles. So the first was efficacy. And so efficacy was just making sure that that a board or that structure has the ability and independence to effectively perform its responsibilities. Sustainability, ensuring that there was continuity of the exchange and that it wasn't subject to changes in administration, and to ensure that it had financial viability. The third and fourth principles were around strategic responsiveness and operational flexibility. Needs to be responsive to rapidly changing markets to meet consumer needs, attract enrollment, and be financially viable. And this really, you know, it's going to need to enroll people in the private market, and so needs to be able to compete and operate in that market. And then the fifth principle is around accountability, so making sure that the exchange had to comply with ethics, open meeting laws, and data practices. So just some state comparisons on governance. So in terms of type, of the 10 states with legislation, 8 of them really are in the public-private realm of governance structures. One of them has chosen to do a state agency, and another one has chosen to operate a nonprofit. for board structure, for size, the average number of members is 10 on those agency on those exchanges that do have a board. For conflict of interest, board members being able to have a conflict of interest and serve on the board, 6 of those states prohibit members on the exchange from having a conflict of interest. 3 allow conflict of interest. In terms of appointing authority, who appoints the members of the board, 4 of the states, all members are appointed by the governor. Another 4 of the states, the appointments are split between the governor and the legislature. And in one state, the appointments are split between the governor and the attorney general. In terms of principles, focusing on some of these aspects, most of the states that have an exchange do not subject that exchange board to rulemaking or to procurement or other administrative processes. And on accountability, all of the states are subject to open meeting laws, ethics, and data practices for their exchanges. So that's just a comparison of kind of what other states have done, in particular relevance to governance. Could talk about these other areas, but I know that time is limited. Yeah. So unless there are questions.
I think those are other jurisdictions. So I appreciate your comments, Director. And are there any – we should take a couple questions, and then let's move into Senator Lori's presenting the bill. So anybody have any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Peterson.
I'm looking back at a slide here, and as I read the bill, looking at your slide that's titled Next Ongoing Steps, there's some
bullet. Is there a number on
it? No, there isn't a slide number on my packet. There's some bullet points that have some required items in the legislation by March 31st, and then we've got the business operations technology sections. Are there elements of Senate File 1, and it looks to be that there are elements of Senate File 1 that are involved with business operations, for example, the navigators and brokers and customer service, call center items. There are elements of Senate File 1 that aren't necessarily in the top section there, which is titled Legislation by March 31st, 2013. My reading of the legislation, is that correct?
Director Momlove.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Peterson. So, and I could, Senator Lurie could address this as well, but the 4 key issues, and I would add appeals to that too as being the 5th one, that need to be addressed with the legislation are all addressed in Senate File 1.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. All right, then. Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm sorry about the slides. I don't know. It must have been something with the projector. And then why don't we invite then Senator Lurie to come to the table. And Commissioner, are you going to stay with us?
Ken.
Okay. Do you want to maybe just make room for him? Let him sit in the middle, and either of you two can go on the sides. Senator Lurie, did you have any more opening comments, or should we pass out your author's amendment?
Go ahead and pass out the author's amendment.
Okay.
That's fine. We can adopt that right away if you want. If somebody's other than me has to offer it, of course. But
let's pass out the author's amendment so we get the bill in the shape that Senator Lurie would like it. And for the new members, it's customary at the first committee hearing that a bill is presented to allow the author to put the bill in the shape he wants it in and then discuss the bill in that shape. And so usually that's not too controversial. We just kind of do that automatically. So I have a copy, so you can keep going. So we're going to pass that out right now. And it is, what do you call this amendment? The A14. Okay.
Are you going to use this or no?
I think we only have. We're really low.
She passed me by. That's what
she did. Maybe she thought. Did she do that side of the table?
Let me just make sure you're passing out the A14 amendment, correct? Excellent.
Yeah, I think they all have it.
Okay, would someone like to offer the author's amendment? Okay. Senator Hayden moves the A14 amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Lurie.
And now I sit before you with Senate File 1. It is, I need to say, very exciting to be here. This has been, let me cover timelines for just a minute. First, going backwards, this is certainly not the culmination because it's the beginning of a new part of the process, but We started the Health Insurance Exchange Task Force, working with the administration and a broad group of legislators and stakeholders from around the state nearly 2 years ago now. And I've been going to these meetings, digging deeply behind these issues. And need to say at the outset, these are very, very important issues regarding a huge segment of Minnesota's economy, one that plays a significant role in people's lives. And makes a difference to people and how they access health care. And so they're very sensitive topics, and I'm acutely aware of that and want people to know that I really do want to carry this bill in a manner that allows a full conversation of the bill and includes all voices. working forward then in the timeline, to just make sure that people understand why we're on a compressed schedule. I know the commissioner mentioned that we are on a compressed schedule with March being required for passage. It's something that I've had to explain verbally to many, many people. This is the first time I've been at a microphone since the New York Times article came out yesterday suggesting that states may have more time to implement their exchanges. We have checked with CMS, and that is actually not the case. We do not have additional time to implement our exchanges, so we're still on our expedited schedule where we need to finish this by March and have a bill passed.
Just a minute, Senator Laurie. Senator Thompson?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, for interrupting, and Senator Laurie. as I take a quick peek at this A14 amendment, I think it's fairly substantive. I didn't know if it was going to be just a comma here and a period there, but I'm wondering if at the very least we could have Senator Laurie kind of go through the significant changes that this represents or even get a little bit of a recess here to get a look at it, because it seems to me it's pretty substantive in nature.
Madam Chair.
I'm sure that Senator Laurie's intention is to explain the amendment, probably
absolutely.
In the context of the bill. The brief, what do we call these? The summary has incorporated the amendment.
And as I step through the bill, Senator Thompson, I will describe the bill as it is amended and try to help you engross it on the fly as well. You'll notice that the amendment is dated today at 2:14 p.m. As you can imagine, again, given the importance of this bill to so many stakeholders, I've been working with a lot of groups and have given some, you know, there is something for everyone to love in this bill, even you, Senator Thompson, I believe. there is something in here for everyone to hate as well, and I understand that. And it makes it a very difficult conversation to approach, but it's an important one for the state of Minnesota. And so I have been working with many stakeholders and have given on some issues that are of particular importance, and I will address those as I get to the bill. So back to and we'll
thank
get there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Laurie, are your changes in the author's amendment just relevant to our committee, or there's some are beyond that? Well, while you're thinking about that, because I would like to try to keep the discussion and the testimony to just the issues that are under our jurisdiction and state
and
local government.
Honestly, I think most of the A14, I mean, the tradition, the history and tradition of the Senate is to allow for this negotiation. We drop a bill. We have a lot of it creates a lot of interest. This one already had it. I didn't need to create interest. But I have been working with a great number of people, and it is the history and tradition that we just allow an author's amendment, such as you did. It puts it into the shape that the author wishes to carry it forward. As I flip through it, I think it's mostly actually state and local jurisdictional items, to tell you the truth.
Okay, why don't you proceed then going through explaining the bill?
Yes. I need just a couple more. Just so that people understand the context in which we're working, I'm going to get back to the timeline and move ahead in time and work backwards. The reason why we're on this short timeline is I think everybody's aware that the Affordable Care Act and the insurance products sold through the exchange will become effective and cover people's lives on January 1, 2014. That is a hard date unless the Congress chooses to change the Affordable Care Act. That's set in law. There's also a law that requires a 33-month open enrollment period. That backs us up to October 1st. And honestly, we need to give the insurance industry 6 months to build the products to populate for that 3-month open enrollment period. That backs us right up to the March 31st date. And we did right away after that article from the New York Times check in to see with CMS, do we have any additional flexibility? Because honestly, it would be helpful and welcomed, but we do not. The January 1, 2014 is hard. You have to have a three-month open enrollment period, and we have to give the industry 6 months to build the products to populate the exchange and make the choices for consumers meaningful. So with those opening comments, and then just also a couple of the main talking points that were already mentioned by the commissioner and April, the exchange director. You know, this is one component of the Affordable Care Act and its implementation. It is the health insurance exchange. It is a large and important one. But myself, as chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, the Budget Committee, I recognize fully this is really insurance reform. It is not really health care reform. It's very important, and I don't mean to indicate anything else, but this is just a cornerstone of what we can use as the foundation for true and meaningful healthcare reform for our people. And so it's important that we do it right, but it's only one piece, and I always think that we need to make that point as we move forward. A couple of the things that will help us move forward well with this, April mentioned this will serve 1.3 million Minnesotans. It's estimated that 300,000 of those are currently uninsured that will be finding insurance products to cover their needs. And that's a huge step forward for Minnesota and our consumers. With those opening comments and the good intro to help get people's minds prepped, I will step into the bill and do my best to kind of engross it with the A14 amendment as we go forward. So Section 1 is it just establishes the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace, which is the name of it today. Again, we're hoping to change that before we're absolutely through with it. Section 1 specifies that in Chapter 13, the classification and sharing of data in the, I'm just going to call it MIM, Minnesota Insurance Marketplace, so I don't have to say things over and over. It's governed by 62V.06. Section 2 is really just that title. Section 3 is definitions. It defines board, health benefit plan, health carrier, individual market, insurance producer. It defines the Minnesota insurance marketplace. It defines navigators. It defines a public health care program. And it offers a definition for small group market. Section 4 states that the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace is created as a board under Section 15.012, which makes it an executive board, not a department or an agency, but a board under the executive branch. One of the reasons this is important, and we had a lot of discussions about where to place it, April mentioned that 8 of the states that have moved with exchange legislation have chosen a similar location with a public-private partnership. Because, again, of the 1.3 million that will enroll through the exchange, 700,000 of them are Medicaid enrollees, and Medicaid determinations have to be done by a public entity, and this is the link with the public that makes us compliant with federal law elsewhere to make sure that they are able to do those Medicaid eligibility determinations, a very core function of the exchange. The rest of this section is really kind of the duties of the marketplace. It's to promote innovation, competition, quality, value, market participation, affordability, meaningful choices, health improvement, care management. And then here's the first piece of the A14 amendment. We included a reduction of health disparities, and then portability of health benefit plans. Was in the original bill. It's also a duty to facilitate and simplify the comparison and choice, enrollment and purchase of health benefit plans for individuals in the individual market and for employees and employers purchasing in the small group market. It's also to assist small employers with access to small business health insurance tax credits and to assist individuals with access to public health care programs and premium assistance tax credits, and the cost-sharing reductions also available through the federal subsidies. It's also item four, to facilitate the integration and transition of individuals between public health care programs and health benefit plans in the individual market. Try to make sure that we address the churn that always occurs at different benefit levels when you move from one categorical eligibility place to another. Subdivision 2, beginning on page 3, is application of other law, and it starts out by stating that the MIM is subject to review by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Item B is that board members, there's also another small clarification in the A14 amendment to make sure that it's board members and the personnel are both subject to ethical practices and the gift ban. Okay. All meetings of the board are to comply with the open meeting law, except those regarding personnel negotiations, contract negotiations, and meetings regarding private, not public, non-public, or trade secret information. On line 3.14, this is where a rather significant amendment from the A14 amendment begins. What we have here in paragraph D is fairly significant exemptions from rulemaking and admin and procurement and OIT. We got significant pushback about the level of exemptions that we had in this bill. And we agreed that some of the oversight and accountability that comes with running a public entity is very important. And so if you try to engross the and I know it's on the fly, but if you try to engross the A14 amendment, this is where the first piece is. We delete lines 316 through 330, which is the exemptions from 14, 16B, 16C, and 16E. And later on in that amendment will be a newly crafted rulemaking authority specific for this entity. So right here, if you engross it, it says that except in 62V.05, which will come up later again in the bill, Minnesota Insurance Marketplace and provisions are exempt from Chapter 14. They are, but we add additional rulemaking later that I'll describe when we get further into the bill. So hope that's making sense. Section 5
Senator is... Metzen, if you'd like to join us at the table for a little while, feel free.
I was sitting over there, yeah. I got a real good seat.
Back. Okay, all right. There's still people standing, so I thought you could free up that seat for somebody. All right, sorry, Senator Laurie.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Section 5 describes the governance structure of the Minnesota insurance marketplace. The board is governed by a board of directors with 7 members. The board membership is made up of, and here's another somewhat significant change in how the board is actually appointed. And let me just maybe back up right now and say the reason for this change. It's still the same 7 members, basically. Well, let me step them through. There's still the 7 members. 3 consumers, 1 member representing public individuals getting coverage in the individual market, 1 representing individuals getting eligibility in the public health care programs, and 1 representing small employers. So all 3 kind of consumers. The other set of 3 is 1, and we split those up in the amendment too, 1 member representing areas of health administration, healthcare finance, health plan purchasing, and healthcare delivery systems. As another 1 representing the areas of public health, health disparities, public health care programs, and the uninsured, and a 3rd representing health policy issues related to the small group and individual markets. The bill, as introduced, had that second group of 3 more industry individuals all lumped into 1, and you could pick and choose, and there was some concern as to whether there would be over-representation of certain interests and under-representation of others, so we kind of grouped those into 3 distinct buckets and made it made those 3 distinct seats. And then the 7th is the Commissioner of Human Services. Under the A14 amendment, all of these appointments are now made by the governor, and confirmed by the Senate. And the reason for that is that one of our experts in running boards like this and constructing them, Mark Shepard, noted that there is, it's hard to read in the Minnesota Constitution, but there's a Minnesota court case that rules that for an executive board such as this is, it's unconstitutional for the legislature to be appointing members. That was kind of news to us. So we had legislative, we had a mix of legislative and gubernatorial appointees on the board as of yesterday morning. Today, we have all gubernatorial appointees with confirmation by the Senate, but they are representing the same interests that you find in the bill if you don't engross it. So that takes us through. And then 4-year terms, staggered terms, one of each group with a 2-year, an initial 2-year term, an initial 3-year term, an initial 4-year term, so that we don't have a supermajority of the board ever coming up at one given time, and so that the board has some political cover to span administrations as they change. I mean, we're all quite familiar with that dynamic here, and to make sure there's some stability and continuity on the board. So there's a staggered initial terms, but then after the first staggered term, they'll all be 4 years from then on out. Conflict of interests. On page 4, line 31, we say that within 1 year prior to any time during their appointed term, board members, other than the commissioner, shall not be employed by, be a member of the board of directors, or otherwise a representative of health carrier, health care providers, navigators, insurance producers, or other entities in the business of selling items or services of significant value or through to or through the Minnesota insurance marketplace. The core tenet there is that really if an individual on this board is receiving actual compensation, a true financial conflict of interest, we're going to not allow them on the board. It's important to note that the board is required to have advisory committees with industry stakeholders, actually specified in the bill later, and to make sure that we don't lose those voices. The voices are certainly important and come with a great deal of expertise that we really do value and want to make sure is not lost in our conversations. The next several subdivisions in this section are rather technical. It says that there's an acting chair appointed by the governor, and that at the first meeting the board will elect their own chair from the board. How the first meeting is called, that the board will elect their own officers. Vacancies, if a vacancy occurs, we had to change this in the A14 to say that the governor will appoint for the balance of that term within 90 days of the vacancy. Removal, the board member may be removed only for cause, and conflict of interest is cause. The board is required to meet at least quarterly. I think they'll need to meet a good deal more than that, at least early on as we work in this changing environment. A quorum is a majority of members, but even if the board is meeting with just a bare majority, you do need an actual majority of the whole board to pass any vote. So it's not just a majority of those attending. Compensation is section 15.0575. That's essentially $55 per day per diem for days that you work on the board, plus expenses, mileage, and other expenses incurred in your capacity serving on that board. Advisory committees, folks might catch that this one says may, I told you that they shall. Shall is later. There's another segment that requires industry advisory committees. This is establishing authority for the board to have additional advisory committees as they see needed, and if they do so, they don't have to. Paragraph B there on line 525 and 26 exempts them from the open appointment process if they do decide to use additional advisory committees.
Senator Lori, let me just interrupt you for a minute, and I wanted to ask Ms. James a question. Is at our first meeting we passed out guidelines for establishing bills or guidelines for establishing boards or advisory groups, and I just want her to I wanted to ask her if she's reviewed the bill and if the bill does comply with our guidelines in establishing boards.
Madam Chair and members, I have reviewed the bill against the guidelines, and in my opinion, Senate File 1, as amended by the A14, does meet the guidelines.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Senator Lori, then proceed.
I should note, as a former member of state and local under Senator Rust, who also had an infamous set of rules to apply to, and an author of an exchange bill last year that didn't comply with all the rules, boy, was I ever in trouble. So I did make sure that we complied with all the rules of state and local. It is actually incredibly important work done in this committee, and I, to this day, apologies
otherwise,
to Senator Rust if she's listening.
Well,
last year's, you
have a board, and nobody has authority to call a meeting.
Oh, exactly. I mean, and that's what these other technical pieces are, and they weren't in last year's exchange bill that I authored. So anyway, Section 6, responsibilities and powers of the insurance marketplace. Of course, they should operate according to this chapter and all other applicable state and federal laws. Generally, the board has the power to employ personnel and delegate administrative, operational, and other responsibilities. Personnel will be in the unclassified service and governed by a compensation plan prepared by the board and submitted to the Commissioner of Management and Budget for review and comment, and then approval by the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the legislature. There's another technical correction in the A14 Amendment 2 for a citation that was improper there, but you'll see that. The board also has the power to establish the budget of the marketplace. It also the ability to seek and accept money, grants, loans, donations, material services, advertising revenue from government agencies, philanthropic organizations, public and private sources to fund the operations of the marketplace. I'm guessing we're not going to get a big fiscal note and for that, saying that we'll gain a lot there, but I think it's really important to give them the flexibility to generate funds independently if they're able to, and hope that really does work. They can also contract for the receipt and provision of goods and services and enter into information sharing agreements with federal and state agencies and other entities, provided these agreements include protections for confidentiality and integrity of the information to be shared and comply with all applicable state and federal laws and regulations. And finally, take any other actions reasonably required to implement and administer the duties. Paragraph C there on 6.16 and 17 is deleted in the A14 amendment. It's part of the rulemaking change, so I'll cover that when we get to it. 6.18 is then paragraph C, and that's within 180 days of an enactment. The board needs to establish bylaws, policies, and procedures. This is a really core and important function because that's the 6 months that is agreed to in the blueprint. It's a hard blueprint. Requirement that we agreed to with the feds when we submitted that back in November. The next several subdivisions are not in our jurisdiction, but I'll try to go through them briefly so that you have a good understanding of the bill, the operations, funding. And these paragraphs A and B, you know, we talked about flipping them because they go backwards in time. But in 2015, the board may retain or collect up to 3.5% of premiums for the individual and small group market plan sold through the marketplace to fund operations of the marketplace. In 2014, so paragraph B there, prior to 2015, we set that at the 3.5%. And you know, so that's to build some reserves so that the marketplace is actually able to fulfill their operational requirements and begin to build the reserves to be able to make sure that they can operate. There is a paragraph C added in the A14 amendment, which clarifies the intent all along. And as we've described this to various groups, the navigator function And the Navigator payment comes out of that 3.5 operational withhold. And so paragraph C that you'll find in the A14 amendment specifies that was somewhat ambiguous to many who read this bill. Subdivision 3 is compensation for insurance producers. Insurance producers are actually more broadly known as brokers, typically. And the board can establish requirements and compensation structures for insurance producers, assisting individuals and small employers with coverage through the marketplace. And within 30 days of an enactment, the Commissioner of Management and Budget needs to establish requirements and compensation for the producers. And those shall remain into effect until the implementation of the requirements and compensation structured in paragraph A. So until such time as the board is able to get their own, the ones that MMB establishes will be operational. Paragraphs C and D are again reversed. So in January 2015, in order to fund this compensation mechanism set aside for insurance producers, the marketplace is authorized to uphold a percentage of premiums from the individual and small group market that is set by this National Association of Insurance Commissioners, ISITE, function, where they estimate the amount of money from insurance products broadly in the market, that Minnesota specific, that are dedicated for this brokering function. And so we kind of set up a pool of broadly what is known as the amount of money set aside for this function. We set that money aside and allow the marketplace to build the compensation structures for the brokers, to build the right incentives into the market to try to incent the ability for small employers to implement defined contribution plans, to help maybe do better outreach to hard-to-serve populations, maybe currently uninsured, maybe people with health disparities, maybe people of color. Try to build the right incentives into the payment structures to make sure that the brokers have a place to be and that they can come and define their role in the new marketplace and be compensated for that. That's what that section is for. Navigators and in-person assisters, subdivision 4. The board may establish policies and procedures for the ongoing operation of a navigator program, in-person assister program, call center, and customer service provisions for the marketplace to be implemented January of 2015. And until those are defined, that's what paragraph B says, the navigator program shall be met by sections 256. Basically, the MNCA program, which is the groups that are helping our current Minnesota Care population find eligibility, and entities eligible to be navigators may serve as in-person assisters. One thing we did strike in the A14 amendment, and this language does have a long history, and we can certainly talk about it, but right now, 725 reads, entities eligible to be navigators, including insurance producers, Indian tribes and organizations, and counties, may serve as in-person assisters. It's an awkward sentence. Including always made me stumble. It was in, it was out. Truthfully, all of these entities, insurance producers, Indian tribes and organizations, and counties, and navigators broadly, and social service entities, all of these people are entities eligible to be navigators, and they really are under federal law.
Okay,
and
Senator Lori, would you skip to the parts that are under our jurisdiction? Because I'm getting nervous about time.
Okay.
Do you want to the appeals? Is that
sure, Commissioner? Okay. Okay.
The appeals section, subdivision 6, 819.
Certification. Okay, appeals, subdivision 6, page 8, line 19. Right.
Yep.
The board may conduct hearings and appoint hearing officers and recommend final orders for determinations except for those under D. If you look down to D, that's really the public program eligibility still goes to the DHS hearing process. So Medicaid and the like would still have access to the DHS appeals processes. The marketplace may establish service-level agreements with state agencies to conduct these hearings and appeals. That may be a much more expeditious manner for them to approach this. And for proceedings under this subdivision, the marketplace may be represented by an attorney who is an employee of the marketplace.
Senator Lurie, I guess you do need to do subdivision 581 as well.
Okay.
Because that's what the board has the power to do.
Okay. Subdivision 5, health care requirements and participation. In January of 2015, the board shall have the power to establish certification requirements for health carriers and health benefit plans offered on the exchange, unless by the end of this legislative session, essentially, we decide that the same rules should apply inside and outside the exchange for individual market and the small group market. And making sure that we meet federal certification requirements. So if this legislature decides that the same rules apply inside and outside the market, then exchange doesn't have the ability to establish certification requirements. But if we don't decide to go that route, this certification requirement will be important for them to be able to establish in 2015. Paragraph B there, the board has the power to select health carriers and health benefit plans for participation in the interests of the individual consumers and employers within the federal requirements. Paragraph C there is what's known as the Indian addendum, and it requires health benefit plans offered on the exchange to use the current Indian addendum, and folks who are heavily engaged understand that better than I do, truthfully, but it is important. We've already done the appeals. Subdivision 7 is agreements and consultation. The board shall establish and maintain an agreement with the OET for information technology services that ensures coordination with public health care programs, and they may establish agreements for other IT services. They shall establish and maintain an agreement with DHS for cost allocation and eligibility determinations and enrollment for public health programs, and may establish and maintain additional agreements for other services. And they shall maintain an agreement with Commerce and with Health for services regarding certification requirements, and may establish and maintain additional agreements with Commerce and Health for other services. The board shall consult with the commissioners of Commerce and Health regarding operations. They shall consult with Indian tribes and organizations regarding the operation of the exchange. And here's where they shall establish advisory committees to provide the healthcare industry, consumers, and other stakeholders with the opportunity to share perspectives regarding the operations of the Minnesota insurance marketplace. At this point, right between lines 918 and 919 is where you'd need to pull out the A14 amendment, starting on line 2.14 of the A14 amendment is the new rulemaking procedure that would be in effect. And essentially, for 1 year following enactment, in order to get this thing up and running quickly, rulemaking is a very long and cumbersome process, and they may adopt rules to implement any provision of this chapter in the following subdivision. The marketplace shall publish the rules in the state register, and interested parties would have 21 days after publication to comment. And after the marketplace had considered all the comments, they shall publish notice in the register that the rules have been adopted, and the rules would take effect on that publication. If the rules adopted are the same, they'll have to say that it's the same as and cite the prior publication. If the rules are different, they'd have to say that they're different and how they're different and cite the original publication as well. And the marketplace shall also seek comments from the Department of Administration, Public Information Policy Analysis Division before adopting any final rules involving the use or disclosure of any not public data. And so that is actually an expedited rulemaking process that's been in operation for a long time in the Department of Health, and it's a very expedited process. I understand that, but it would be just for that first year of operation to get them the ability to get those initial rules promulgated. And then paragraph F there is making sure that those rules are submitted back to the legislature next year in 2014 to take a good look at what was done, and we'll have the opportunity to review it at that point. Subdivision 9, beginning on the top of page 3 of the A14 amendment, is after the first year, the board may adopt rules to implement provisions using the expedited rulemaking process outlined in 14.389. That the expedited rulemaking process is really the one that takes about 6 months. So that just for members' information. Then getting back to data, you know, that's really a judiciary. I can go over data if you want.
No, just go funds, over the sunset exclusion.
Funds, well, in the report, shall submit reports. It's section 9 on page 10. There it is. Submit a report to the legislature by January 15th of 2015, and each January 15th thereafter on the performance of the marketplace operations, meeting their responsibilities, and on an accounting of the marketplace budget and activities. Section 10 is actually cleaned up. It's the same thing that you could read there, but it's cleaned up in the A14 amendment. It is not subject to sunset, and its provisions would continue to go. Transition of authority is probably yours as well, and that is just saying that upon the effective date of this, the Commissioner of Management and Budget will transfer everything that they've been working on. The exchange will basically move from MMB over to this newly created exchange. And then Section 12 is MCHA, very important, but probably not. Well, it's a repeal, I guess. It's a phase out of MCHA, so it might have some link. And basically, MCHA is our high risk pool that we've had since the 70s, I think. Important and popular product in Minnesota, and there's always been with guaranteed issue, the need for a high risk pool basically goes away. But the 26,000 individuals, people served in Minnesota by MCHA, don't go away. And we had been planning for an orderly phase out of MCHA. There are some federal regulations that might mean that could cost the state a great deal of money. So we're just really working with the MCHA board and the Department of Commerce and really trying to make sure that whatever we do to phase out MCHA is done in an orderly fashion, and that the individuals currently served with those products are given all the support that they need to transfer into the broader marketplace successfully with as little disruption as possible.
Okay, thank you, Senator Lurie.
And effective dates.
Questions by members of the committee? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lurie. Madam Chair, I was just asking if maybe Senator Lurie could go through the data section in the bill in light of the fact that the open meeting section is definitely related to governance, both referring to Chapter 13. I think it actually is relevant to the governance conversation. I just ask for your indulgence, Madam Chair.
Okay, the bill is going to Judiciary Committee after this to look at the data privacy section, but I will indulge Senator Peterson. Senator Lurie.
Sure. Page 19, line 19, Section 7, data. Definitions in Section 13.02 apply. And government data, which is actually all data of the marketplace on individuals, employees, employees of employers and employers using the marketplace, are private data on individuals or non-public data, and the marketplace may not share non-public data with state and federal agencies and other entities if the exchange of the data is reasonably necessary to carry out the functions of the marketplace. And state agencies shall share not public data with the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace if the exchange of the data is reasonably necessary to carry out the functions of the marketplace. And the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace may derive summary data from non-public data under this section as well.
Okay, and we should let the Data Privacy Committee deal with that.
Yeah,
other questions? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lori, I am incredibly thankful for your open mind and your willingness to listen to a lot of the people who came to us to talk about the Chapter 14 issue and kind of the exemption that was established there and how you handled this so well and so quickly. I'm impressed because I just didn't know how we were going to manage the whole issue of trying to do this, you know, in the time frame that you had and, you know, the controversy around just getting it done and then making sure that we have transparency and that we had a rule. As you know, in this committee, we had extensive conversations even about abolishing the rulemaking process for 2 years. So it has been a very important issue, I think, to many members. So this was important, and I am very appreciative of your effort to resolve it. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lori.
Senator Torres Ray. I suppose on that point, I should say this is an attempt to give some. And again, there's people who are going to like what I've given and people who are not going to like what I've given. I don't believe we've addressed all of the controversy, but we're trying to weigh carefully the need to be nimble and the need to be open and accountable and transparent in what we do. And it's a very, very difficult balancing act. So I have worked to move towards, you know, basically away from some of the nimbleness that had been in the bill and towards more of the openness and transparency that we, you know, expect and deserve in our public processes. So we'll see how this one flies. You know, there will be I don't want to present it as a compromise that has been accepted by everyone. So if I did that, it was unintentional. There's still going to be much conversation, but I appreciate your comments.
Senator Lori, you might comment just a little bit. We'd had a private conversation about the need for nimbleness
yes.
by the exchange. You might want to make some comments on that.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's widely known that we're in a changing environment. I mean, the feds aren't done with the issuing rules themselves. We're in a changing environment. The insurance market, the healthcare market is going to be trying to respond and build systems and products that can meet individuals' needs. And in order for the insurance marketplace to be responsive broadly to individuals' needs and the market's needs, frankly, and be responsible actor in this new market, they're really going to need to have that ability to respond quickly to changing environments that come online in ways that are unseen. So, I mean, if you just think about it in context of our historic two-year rulemaking process, I mean, if it took the marketplace 2 years to make any decision, it just wouldn't work. I mean, this market, the exchange is really going to have to be much more nimble than that. I don't think anybody's challenging that assumption. And, you know, Ms. Malmlov also has some good insights if you want to dig a little deeper into the nimbleness or if you want to add something, you'd be...
I think just to give an example, I think that would be helpful. So if the exchange board, for example, is establishing what the certification requirements are and say that those certification requirements come in and the plans are submitting products under those certification requirements, the premiums for those plans might be higher than what the board would like to see. And it might be hard to attract small businesses, for example, that aren't eligible for tax credits into the exchange if premiums outside the exchange are much cheaper. So it would impact their enrollment, their ability to be financially sustainable. If the board, however, was able to be more nimble in establishing those rules, it could say, okay, these rules that came in, are there rules that we established, the premiums for these plans are too expensive, we need to reconsider our rules, and in a month, plans we want you to resubmit products and rates for those products based on a modification of those rules. And so having the flexibility to be able to do that to create more cost-effective products for consumers would be important.
Great, thank you. Okay, members, this is the time for questions, clarification questions. We'll take a few more questions on that. Then we'd like to take testimony, then consider amendments, and then have debate and vote on the bill. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Senator Lori, there's some concern about this conflict section because it almost seems like it's eliminating a class of people who have recent expertise in the area of medicine and insurance and the like. And as I understand it, the federal law does not require such a section, and that, in fact, the task force specifically recommended that there be some exceptions for certain board members. What was the purpose of doing that in light of the task force recommendations? It almost seems like in conflict of law, normally we try to give people reasons to recuse themselves if they think. But this just seems to be eliminating a class of people, and why would we do that?
Senator Lori.
Senator Pappas, Senator Thompson, you know, the conflict of interest is something that does create a good deal of conversation and a great deal of discomfort with some members. But really, I mean, if you think about it, it's really for 1 year, you know, prior to your appointment to the board, you can't have had that direct financial conflict of interest. I mean, if an insurer, you know, or a health plan is actually paying your salary, and that's one hat that you wear, that where you get the lion's share of your compensation as an individual. And if you're on this board, that's whole purpose is to make the exchange work for the benefit of individuals, that's a very different hat. And the conflicts become very apparent, and when we think about a recusal policy, truthfully, almost everything this board does is regarding insurance products, and so the recusal would have to be so broad, it would almost be eliminating that member from participation in much of anything that board took up. I think April mentioned of the 10 states that have adopted exchange legislation thus far, six have said that they wouldn't allow any direct conflict of financial conflict of interest on the board. And this is not – you're right that the federal law does not require us to do this, but this is also not the strongest form of financial conflict of interest we could do either. I mean, you know, another big issue that we always have is revolving door. We don't say that you can't take a job immediately upon leaving this board. There's more protections that we could give, but I think the people of Minnesota broadly want this board to be a board that's taking actions on their behalf and that they can trust, and so that the work that they do needs to have the trust of the people of Minnesota. And I think that making sure that it's free from direct current financial conflicts of interest is a really critical cornerstone of building that public trust.
Other questions for Senator Lori? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lori, and this may be a silly question, but I was just wondering.
There are no silly questions.
Some are. Not this one, I'm sure, but.
You just proved my point. I was going to say only silly legislators. So thank you, Senator Lori. Give me an example of one. I see the language here says one member representing the interests of individual consumers eligible for individual market coverage, and then so on and so forth. They go through the members that represent the interests of these various groups. Give me an example, I guess, of an organization or entity that represents these individual consumers eligible to purchase coverage. You had to have had something in mind when you wrote the legislation. So just give me an example of a few of these interests, these collective
sure.
interests.
Sure. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, from the perspective of an individual, it's really important. If you're the one that's actually the boots on the ground navigating this system, trying to use it for your benefit, if you're a small business, if you're an individual buying a product on the individual market, or if you're an individual gaining access to Medicaid coverage through this, Your experiences and your interactions with this are a core piece of what this board does. And so, I mean, it would be, you know, hopefully a really engaged and interested and individual with a great deal of depth and knowledge and passion about how this board works and works for the benefit of people like them. And so, I mean, it's just a person, again, seeking products on this exchange through the individual market, a person seeking products on this board through the public programs, largely Medicaid, a small business. You know, I mean, we had members on the task force representing each of these groups and brought incredibly valuable perspectives and insights into how we entertained conversations, and were really valuable members of the work that we did. And I think their work would be incredibly valuable. And in fact, an individual consumer, correct me if I'm wrong, it's actually a federal requirement to have an individual consumer on the board. Correct? Yeah. So, I mean, that's really pulled, the individual consumer piece is pulled directly from the ACA as a requirement that we need to meet. But, you know, when I put a little flesh on that bones, that's what I see.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Lori. Now, this is actually a state board created and not a department, so it won't be subjected to the usual legislative oversight that you'd see in a state department, correct?
Well, it's subject to OLA. It's subject to much of 16 now. It's subject to expedited rulemaking, but it's still subject to rulemaking. It's subject to, you know, under here, much of what's in state government, but it's exempted from much as well.
We could follow up?
Yes, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lori, I did notice in the amendment that an exception was created that this board would not be subject to 16.8.1283, which I had no idea what that was, but fortunately God made smartphones for dumb legislators, so I was able to find out. And that actually would allow the board to raise revenue without that going through the legislative process, correct?
Can you point me to –
Sure. I'm looking, Madam Chair and Senator Lori, I'm looking at your amendment.
The A14 amendment,
line 1.6 in your amendment refers to page 3, line 15. If I'm reading this correctly, if you go and look at this in the context of the original bill – The board would be excepted, E-X-C-E-P-T-E-D, from Chapter 14, including Sections 14.386 and Section 16A.1283. Well, 16A.1283 requires legislation to raise money, so this board is being excepted from that and wouldn't even be required to have legislative approval to raise money, right?
Well, that not raise taxes on individuals. I'm sure that goes back to the powers of the board to, you know, raise advertising fees and solicit donations and things like that. I mean, I didn't track 16A.1283. It wasn't in the. Okay, and it allows for the operations funding and the insurance producers funding, the 3.5 and that insurance producers funding. So
and the 3.5.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the 3.5 is something that could be assessed, but of course, when an insurance company performs its actuarials to set premiums, it factors in potential risk to set its premiums, and it doesn't set this fee in here. So, in fact, this would end up essentially being a fee assessed by a board without legislative approval. Is that right?
Well, there's
Senator Lori,
Senator Pappas, Senator Thompson. There's approval in this legislation. I mean, that's what this is, and it's the approval by the legislature to collect withhold from premiums up to that 3.5% for operations.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Senator Lori, does it not bother you a little bit that, yes, we give this broad sweeping authority that this statute is asking for, but it is essentially taking a board that is not a state agency, government department, not directly accountable to the legislature other than to basically make an annual report. And we don't have traditional legislative oversight, and they can assess these kinds of fees. You don't see that as a little bit of overreach?
Sarah Laurie.
Senator Pappas, Senator Thompson, in establishing the exchange, they're going to need to be able to have some certainty in the budgets that they operate on. I mean, the alternative here, I guess I'll need to say, is really a federal exchange. If we don't implement one, and the federal exchange is a 3.5% withhold, very similar to what is in this. I mean, this is what we're faced with at this point. The financing of this mechanism will get a good deal of attention in the Finance Committee, and this is another area there's certainly a lot of tension. But this exchange is going to need to get the revenue to function, and the revenue in the current form is from a 3.5% withhold of premiums, and that.
Okay.
Okay,
thank you.
To get that done.
Thank you, Senator Law. I'd like to move on to testimony. And if the three of you would like to move away from the table, I'd like to bring people up in teams just to expedite the process. So if Jay McLaurin, Chris Schneeman, and Mike Hickey would come to the table and have you kind of each testify individually, but you'll all be sitting there. And Senator Laurie, maybe you want to take that chair at the end of the table here so that you're close by, or even pull that chair up to the table would be fine.
She is.
Okay, be close. Okay, welcome to the committee. Mr. McLaurin? All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jay McLaurin, and I'm the Director of Government Relations at Medica.
Did we get your name spelled wrong, or it is McLaurin?
McLaurin, M-C-L-A-R-E-N. I think
okay.
It's correct on
all right,
the agenda.
You. I just pronounced it wrong. Sorry.
Oh, not at all. Thank you, Madam Chair. So today I'm with Medica, but I'm testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Want to first start off by saying the council supports creating a state-based health insurance exchange in Minnesota. And we greatly appreciate the leadership that Senator Laurie has been providing on this issue, not just this year, but in prior years as well, in getting legislation introduced and trying to get it passed through the legislature. We appreciate him working with us on a number of issues and continuing to work with us on issues, and we appreciate that. And in terms of the council, we, in creating a health insurance exchange, we believe it's important to focus on three different things. Number one is that the exchange has to be able to work for Minnesota. Along with its histories and traditions that come with our healthcare system. Second, we have to be mindful of the affordability for all Minnesotans, including those who will be using the exchange. And also, we'd like to focus, we encourage folks to focus on meeting minimum federal requirements so the state, so that there are not too many additional requirements placed on the exchange, so that it still has a chance to get up and running by October 1st, as they've been planning for. We have a number of concerns with the bill that we've shared with Senator Laurie. I'll focus on the ones in front of the committee this evening. So our first concern has to do with the composition of the board of directors for the exchange, which has been changed slightly by the amendment. We have concerns with how that correlates with the federal regulations of how the board needs to be comprised. There's a specific part of federal regulations that requires that a majority of the board have specific types of expertise. Some are listed in the bill. Some need to be modified to reflect the federal regulations. And then the structure, overall structure of it needs to be changed. One of the big areas of difference has to do with the language that remains in the bill stating that several members have to have demonstrated experience, leadership, and innovation in several areas. Which is different from the federal standard, which requires that it be relevant experience. So having actual experience in health plan administration, have actual experience in healthcare financing and the like. So those are some of the concerns that we have with the composition of the board, along with some other more technical requirements within that. Also, when it comes to the language on the conflict of interest policy, which remains in the bill on lines 4.31 to 4.36. We have concerns about that, and it goes back to our main principle that we want this exchange to work for Minnesota. We want to leverage the some of the things that have happened in our state in the past around our health care system that have contributed to our success that's the envy of many other states across the country. I know that we obviously still have issues in our healthcare system we need to address, but we do have a lot of infrastructure that is the envy of other states. One's been mentioned tonight, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, the state's high-risk pool, is one of the few high-risk pools across the country that works well. Health plans are represented on their board of directors. Another has to do with improvements in healthcare quality. We have a state's organization called the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, or ICSI, where we have input and we have representation there. The organization that makes public and shows Minnesotans the quality of healthcare that's being provided in our clinics and hospitals is Minnesota Community Measurement. It was created by Minnesota's health insurance carriers. It was created by Minnesota's health plans. We have representation on the board, along with some of the other groups in this conflict of interest policy that would not be able to offer their relevant experience, current experience, with the health insurance exchange. So we're concerned that there would be this history and tradition in Minnesota of this collaborative approach to healthcare that wouldn't follow through with implementing something that's so important in improving our uninsured rate here in Minnesota and adding this value to so many different Minnesotans. So we are concerned with that as well, and we'll continue to work with the author on that. Another area has to do with transparency and oversight, and we appreciate the changes that Senator Lori's brought tonight in his A14 amendment. We still believe there may be some areas for improvement in that, including that the rules, it essentially makes it optional for the board to use expedited rulemaking after the first year, because it is if you turn to page 3, line 1, says beginning 1 year after enactment, the board may adopt rules to implement provisions in this chapter using expedited rulemaking. So it's still optional. It's not a requirement. And it still treats this board differently from other boards and state boards and even agencies in state government, where they have to abide by the normal rulemaking process, and this would be allowed to choose an alternative route compared to that. And to that point, the health insurance carriers and the products that we offer within the exchange are going to be responding to what the customers and consumers within the exchange want. That's what we're going to be doing. Most of the things that will come from the exchange task or exchange board will be new requirements and regulations, largely that are placed on the marketplace. And it's good to have a robust process for public input on those, and also advanced knowledge of those as we build our products to abide by them in the future. So we think it would be that the rulemaking portion of this may have some room to be beefed up. And we also are looking at some of the other issues that have been discussed here previously, where after this board is handed over from MMB, it has to consult with a couple of different agencies, but it doesn't have kind of direct oversight by a state department or state agency, and that may add some value to get to some of the concerns that we've heard around accountability. And Madam Chair and members, I appreciate once again the leadership of Senator Loring bringing this together, and we appreciate working with him to continue to look at these issues, and I appreciate the ability to offer my testimony tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McLaren, and thank you for being brief. And I would like to ask all the witnesses to please try to be brief and to the point and not be repetitive. So then, Mr. Scheman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I am Chris Scheman. I own an independent insurance agency. We have 10 employees downtown St. Paul here. We're called Seven Hills Benefit Partners. And we have a business that helps over 200 small employers and several thousand individual policyholders manage their health insurance options. But I'm here today representing what's called the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform. This is comprised of the four predominant professional agent associations operating in Minnesota, which includes the Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters, the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the Professional Insurance Agents, and the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers, commonly referred to as the Big I. Collectively, we represent over 54,000 Minnesota licensed professional insurance agents and their employees. As such, we work very closely today with both group and individual consumers on a daily basis. Agents have supported and continue to encourage an insurance exchange that supports our unique Minnesota care system and its competitive insurance markets. Our members have spent countless hours participating in Governor Dayton's Health Insurance Exchange Task Force, and we've invested quite a bit of effort into influencing those recommendations in as positive a way as we can. That being said, we do have serious concerns about the bill as it was initially introduced, and today I'll focus my concerns just relevant to this committee's interest.
Thank you.
Number one, we're concerned that while many or most of the task force members supported a public-private partnership for the exchange, this bill sets the exchange up as a public agency or board with no real private sector elements. While it has been stated that this is due to the need for a state agency to complete Medicaid eligibility determinations, we see ample evidence in other states that it is possible for an exchange to be modeled after MCHA and delegate the Medicaid determination responsibilities to DHS and other counties. We are concerned, number two, that the exchange is exempt from the rulemaking process, and it would be able to make so many important decisions without the public input or really in the public view. It also lacks the kind of appeal remedies that are generally available through an administrative hearing process. And even with Senator Lori's amendments, we still remain concerned with the powers of the board as it stands. Third, we are also very concerned about the makeup of the board and the fact that it excludes those with expertise and experience in the health insurance market, including agents and insurance carrier employees. There seems to be a unique view of conflict of interest that suggests that only those with practical experience with the needs of consumers are the ones with conflict, while activists and others who bring their own agendas to the table seem not to have a conflict. The reality is that everyone who serves on the board can and probably will have a conflict at some time. Even consumers have a conflict. For example, there will be votes that come up on the inclusion of a particular benefit or policy feature that might impact a board member's personal situation or that of someone that they're close to. The proper way to handle this issue is to adopt a policy that anyone with a conflict on a given issue must recuse themselves from the vote on that particular issue. The exchange is set up to serve all Minnesotans, and we should not exclude anyone for board eligibility. Finally, we strongly disagree with the provision on compensation of insurance producers. This bill requires a politically appointed board to not only set agents' compensation, but to also limit customers' access to independent advice. The state's own surveys show that Minnesota agents are the second lowest paid in the country, while those same agent services are very highly valued by customers in our state. I know of no other sector in the economy where the government sets wage and price controls on a successful competitive marketplace. In the Navigator Agent Work Group of the Task Force, the exchange staff handed out a chart that showed what other states are doing with regard to this agent compensation issue, and we've provided copies here that I'll distribute when we're finished. Not one of the other states took the approach in the bill where agent compensation would be aggregated by the exchange and then dictated by the governing board as to where it's going to go. In fact, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Illinois, Maryland, and Nevada all left the compensation question to stand between agents and their carriers. At the time the handout was created, Massachusetts set a rate schedule that was generally higher than what we are being paid here in Minnesota, and it's unclear where Arizona was going to take it. Oregon was the only state where the exchange was involved in agent compensation at all, and they simply became a pass-through for commissions between the carriers and the agents for any exchange-related business. These states understand that carriers voluntarily pay their agents and that they demand tremendous value for the compensation that they pay. Thank you for your time, and thanks very much for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, Mr. Schneeman. Mr. Hickey.
Madam Chair, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. Trying to be not repetitive and on target for what the committee wants to talk about may take my testimony out here, but I wasn't sure how narrow the scope was of our discussion and review here today. I did want to talk about the assessment compensation for insurance agents criteria for plans writing in the exchange, the rulemaking exemption, and also the conflict of interest provision on the board. Can I make some brief comments on those 5 points?
Okay, go ahead, Mr. Hickey.
Okay, thanks.
As long as you stay within your 5 minutes.
Sure, absolutely. No, it will be brief. We're concerned about the assessment provision, and while it's not Senator Lori's intent to have this new 3.5% assessment passed on to people who are receiving a plan in the exchange, it may be very difficult to make the plans to prevent them from passing that on. And I want to keep a conversation going with Senator Lori on that. I have talked to a couple of people in the insurance industry are very knowledgeable, and maybe unless there's language prohibiting that, they are going to be able to pass it on. It also brings up a related issue in the ACA. It was discussed earlier that you have to price plans similar within the exchange and not within the or outside the exchange. And so if we put a 3.5% assessment that we can't prohibit from being passed on to the plans in the exchange, that may end up falling on the people outside the exchange. I think the vast majority of my members are probably not going to be buying a plan in the exchange. We're hearing estimates of 10 to 30% of the population possibly participating in the exchange. That means 70, 80% or more aren't. And this would really be a bad result if we have a 3.5% assessment on those people because of the other language and the difficulty dealing with all the language in the ACA in totality. So that's a real concern and one we need to really look at. And I know that's not the intent, but this could become a bit of a legal morass, and we need to take a hard look at that. Second, we're very concerned about, excuse me, I'm struggling with a bad throat, the language about the insurance agents and really over-regulating their compensation, and feel it's not the way to go. We should definitely allow the plans and the agents to work these matters out the way private markets do. And so we're very concerned about that provision. The vast majority of states, it sounds like, have not gone down that road, and really urge you to take a second look at that. We're also concerned about the criteria that could prohibit a lot of the our current insurers from participating in the exchange. The board has a final say on that. I don't totally understand that provision, but the board is going to have a lot of say on that or the final say on that, and we think any insurer that meets the criteria to offer a plan in that exchange should. I think choice should be a real goal here. And we should include as many insurers or any insurer that meets the criteria. Number four, appreciate the changes on rulemaking. I'm not an expert on rulemaking, even though I've, I guess, had the privilege to participate in it a few times over the years. I don't know the exact difference between expedited and normal, but we should take a look at that. And I think we don't want the exchange moving too fast and catching people off guard, especially in the private sector, not knowing that new things have occurred that could have a negative impact on their premium, their livelihood or whatever. And possibly we want to try to compare the difference between expedited and normal. And five, regarding the conflict of interest provision on the board, well, I really think the one-year provision is way too long. Possibly we should just say not currently employed, but you look at all the people who possibly have just retired who maybe could bring tremendous expertise to the exchange, and the one-year requirement, it might be really hard to find somebody who's 1 year out of employment who'd be interested in doing this now, and so possibly not currently employed would be a better way to go. It might expand the pool dramatically of people to serve on this board, and especially of people with tremendous expertise in the insurance area, since this is what the board does. And so we're working with Senator Lori and Representative Atkins, and just wanted to share our concerns and briefly with you today.
All right. Thank you very much. Let's move on and call up the next team, Ron Elwood and Kate Johansson. They're not really a team, but... We hope we're all on the same team. They're both lawyers, at least. Welcome to the committee. Why don't you start, Mr. Elwood?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Ron Elwood, Legal Aid, and hopefully by the end of this, we'll all be a team. I want to thank Senator Lurie for his leadership on this. And first, I'd like to just say I appreciate the approach that he's taken with the board. And I want to stress that I think we need, there's a strong need for a manageable, objective, and independent board. I think that's critical to the success of the exchange. I'd also like to applaud and the appropriately strong conflict of interest section that Senator Lurie has provided. We clearly need expertise. There's no question about that. But there is an overriding principle here that I don't believe we can compromise, and that is that this exchange is conceived and will be operated in the public interest. And we simply cannot have board members whose personal interest or the interest of the entity that they represent conflict with or jeopardize the public interest. I appreciate the opportunity to offer some comments.
All right. Thank you for being brief. Ms. Johansson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and thank you for the opportunity to comment on Senate File 1. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employer members, 80% of which are small businesses that are eligible for participation in a Minnesota state health insurance exchange. The Chamber first wants to thank Senator Lurie for his very hard work on this very difficult issue and his efforts to collaborate with many stakeholders on it to get a good bill result. The Chamber has long supported the legislative creation of a state insurance exchange that empowers consumers and maximizes consumer choice within a marketplace. While we do have some concerns about the bill in its current form, we appreciate that Senator Lurie's sentiment is that this is a starting point, not an ending point, and we look forward to working with him on the bill. With respect to governance specifically, the Chamber actually supports the creation of a private nonprofit entity to govern the state exchange. But to be constructive to this committee, I'll keep my comments targeted to areas that are specific to the bill and just add nuance to issues that have already been brought up that we can perhaps augment in useful ways. Of the concerns that the Chamber would have, the first would be rulemaking. We're very appreciative of the A14 amendment, although the Chamber's preferred position would be that the board have some sort of emergency rulemaking authority for an amount of time and then be subject to standard rulemaking and perhaps a look-back period with rules that were promulgated under that emergency period. We think that that's appropriate for transparency, and we just think that it is similar to other boards that also do important work in fast-changing fields. Second, we have some concerns about board composition. First, making sure that they comport with federal requirements, using the word experience instead of the words expertise, innovation, and leadership. And also concerns that putting that bucket together of carriers, providers, brokers, and agents dilutes the participation of groups that have really rich experience that will be necessary to making sure Minnesota Exchange succeeds. So we would hope to see perhaps additional discussion on that particular issue. Third, we still have some concerns with the conflict of interest. This may be where Mr. Elwood and I are no longer a team. But we actually support the task force recommendation that provides for a recusal process. I think that recusal might be a small price to pay, again, to access the experience that would be really helpful to administering a state exchange board. And then finally, with respect to oversight, I believe Senator Thompson's comments got at this earlier. I think that a board with significant power should have proportionate oversight and perhaps some sort of oversight of that appropriation, even of a dedicated fund, would be appropriate. So again, I really want to thank Senator Lurie for collaborating with us and other stakeholders and look forward to continuing to work with him and all of you on the bill.
Great. Thank you for those excellent comments. Next, I'd like to bring up Mary Jo George and Liz Doyle. Welcome
to
the
committee. Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Jo George, and I am the Associate Director of Advocacy for AARP Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate File 1 and would also like to extend our thanks to Senator Lurie for his leadership on this bill. We will address our comments just to the establishment of the exchange and the governance issues. AARP represents nearly 700,000 members statewide. 44% of whom are between the ages of 50 and 64. For many of our members in our in this age group, finding access to affordable health care coverage has been difficult and challenging. Excuse me. And for many of those who are lucky enough to find individual coverage, they often pay premiums that are 2 to 3 times higher than those in the employer-based coverage. Thus, we believe the exchange, the development of an exchange that is consumer-friendly and that is vital to addressing issues around those who do not have coverage is important, but also for improving access and affordability for those who are already in the market. Overall, we are very supportive of the goals in the bill, in the establishment of the exchange, including promoting quality, increasing affordability, and improving health outcomes. Additionally, we support many of the transparency provisions in the bill, including the public meetings and public participation in the exchange decision-making. AARP believes that exchanges should ensure that all policy and operational choices be considered through the lens of the consumer. And so we, too, feel that it is very important to have strong consumer representation and a conflict-free governing board. Our position is this. Since the Affordable Care Act assigns the exchanges the responsibility and oversight and regulation of the insurance plans within the exchange, we do believe those with a financial interest should not serve on the exchange board. But we'd agree with Senator Lori that the creation of the advisory committees is a very important role for those with this expertise, and that they could provide the guidance and the knowledge to the board if they lack that expertise. With regard to the composition of the board, we would prefer that consumers serve in a majority position, but we are fine with the language as is, as long as, of course, the conflict of interest provisions stay intact. Finally, we are supportive of the author's amendment that clarifies the healthcare backgrounds in the second section of the board membership. We think it is important to make distinctions about the categories of expertise, so we appreciated that creating the three distinctions, and we think this is important because we want to have broad diversity and knowledge on the board, and somebody that is specifically appointed with a background serving underserved populations and those that have expertise in health disparities. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. George. Ms. Doyle.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Liz Doyle, Associate Director with Take Action Minnesota, and we're a statewide multi-issue organization that works for expanding access to quality, affordable health care here in Minnesota. We want to also echo the appreciation and thanks to Senator Lori for authoring this legislation, for his leadership on this issue. This legislation and this health insurance exchange is going to offer tremendous benefits for improving access to affordable coverage for over 1 million in the state. Just a moment of a context on the issues that this committee is looking at. Minnesota consumers are seeing a very dramatic increase in their cost of their health care in the state, and that is disproportionately impacting the small group and individual market. Premiums in both of those markets have far outpaced inflation for the last decade. Out-of-pocket costs in both the small group and individual market are soaring. According to the most recent data from the Department of Health, a third of the families in the small group market have out-of-pocket limits for their health coverage above $6,000 a year. Two-thirds of families in the individual market have out-of-pocket limits above $6,000 a year. So we're seeing, you know, a tremendous cost in the cost of health plan and health plans in the market that are covering less. The health exchange finally offers us a wonderful opportunity to level the playing field for individuals and small employers, give them the ability to get better value out of the healthcare market as large employers in the state have been able to do for several years. A strong conflict of interest provision is critical to fulfilling this role effectively. Individuals who sell products on the exchange or who are otherwise actively profiting from the exchange cannot reasonably be expected to offer an unbiased view of which products are in the best interest of consumers and small businesses. The financial conflict of interest would both undermine the interest of consumers and it would create an uneven playing field among those who are seeking to sell products on the exchange. To the extent that the exchange is able to negotiate with plans for better value for individuals and small employers, including those with a conflict of interest, in essence, put those entities on both sides of the table. Finally, as Senator Lori mentioned, a critical piece of the health insurance exchange to its success is ensuring public's trust, the trust of the public, and having a board that can operate free of financial conflict of interest is something the public understands and will support. The conflict of interest standard that's in this legislation is a very reasonable one. As the director mentioned earlier, most of the states around the country that have designed their exchange either in legislation or in an executive order have included conflict of interest standards that are equally strong, if not stronger. In a couple of states, the look-back period actually extends beyond your service in the exchange board, so that conflict of interest standard extends a year beyond the time that you served on the board. In other states, they've applied it to family members of individuals who are serving on the board. So this is a reasonable and modest conflict of interest standard and one that's important for the viability of the board. We would just, in closing, say that the conflict of interest standard in combination with having a manageable, reasonable number of individuals on the board are both important to make sure that the board can operate effectively and nimbly in this new environment. So we would urge the members of the committee as this moves forward to keep in mind that the health insurance exchange is really designed to promote the interests of individuals and small businesses and continue to be vigilant to those interests moving forward. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much for those comments. Now we have the last two testifiers, Twyla Braze and Matt Schaefer.
Thank you,
Welcome
Madam
to
Chair.
The committee, Ms. Braze.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We've long been opponents of the health insurance exchange, so this is probably not news to anybody around the table here. But what I want to do is I want to explain particularly what this is about. Wouldn't you know, I just lost my first sheet of paper. I'm sorry. Okay. So I think it's just important to understand the structure that's being created, which is a little bit hidden within the bill. And so the bill title says that this is a marketplace, but according to the bill, on line 2.21, the marketplace is created as a board. And I think that has been stated here. But just the fact that we keep talking about a marketplace is problematic to our organization because it's actually a state board. Furthermore, just to make sure that you understand exactly how much this is not a marketplace, it says that it has a dedicated state government account on line 9.31. It gets state appropriations. It must establish agreements with state departments, has to report annually to the legislature, has to establish an appeals process, and is not allowed to ever go away, although I know that language has changed a little bit, but it's still really not allowed to go away. So that's not a marketplace. Yet the bill exempts this board from rulemaking, and it still continues to exempt the board from rulemaking. And even the new language that Senator Lori has put out still exempts it from rulemaking. Because the first year, even though they have to put out and they have to ask for public comments, they don't get to do what rulemaking allows to do with public comments, or rather the public doesn't get to do. In other words, with rulemaking, if you put in 25 letters, the department is required to hold an administrative hearing. In expedited rulemaking, which is what he's offering instead after the first year, there's not even expedited in the first year. With expedited rulemaking, only if it mentions in the statute that the public is allowed to have input like 100 letters and then an administrative hearing, is that allowed. In other words, the reason why the health department has been doing expedited rulemaking without the 100 letters and without no opportunity for the public to have an administrative hearing is because they know our organization and some others could actually get an administrative hearing and it would slow them down. So what we really have here still is no rulemaking the way rulemaking is meant to be, to give the public meaningful opportunity to object to what is happening here. Now, the other thing, of course, is that it's exempt from the Government Data Practices Act. And that means the Tennyson warning, which tells people whether they have to give data or not. It means all sorts of other transparency.
Ms. Brace, that's not in our jurisdiction.
I understand that, but I'm trying to create what the structure is. So here's what's particularly interesting about that, if you understand what the structure is. And I'm sorry, I forgot to pass these out. Is there a
Our page can come and do that.
So in there is a diagram of the structure. So if you look at the bill, despite the fact that it never actually mentions it, the exchange that's enabled through this bill would establish the largest ever data system for the purpose of tracking individuals and sharing data. Now, even though data is not part of the jurisdiction, the structure of this is part of the jurisdiction. So the structure is actually a board, and a board that has all this money, you know, $50 to $60 million of money, and it has all this authority to run the IT infrastructure. And the IT infrastructure, as soon as you see the diagram, will show all the places that the board, that the infrastructure goes to share data, where they get all the data from all the different state agencies, from the federal government, and from other entities. And then above and beyond that, this IT infrastructure that is being created here, that will be under the governance of the board, is then allowed to connect to what I would consider the mother of all IT superstructures, which is the Federal Data Services Hub. And the Federal Data Services Hub is being created by the federal government as the place to go for the sharing of the information. So it's going to go to Homeland Security, it's going to go to SSA, it's going to go to the IRS. So in short, what this bill does is it enables Minnesota to connect to the federal IT superstructure for what writers in the USA Today recently called the largest consolidation of personal data in the history of the republic. And note that once this structure is set up, the federal hub and the state arms, because this bill is just creating the Minnesota arm into the superstructure, once it is set up, it can be used for all sorts of things, above and beyond health data or insurance. So finally, I wanted to let you know that Senate File 1 establishes this is outside the superstructure. So I just want to say and make it very clear that Senate File 1 establishes the federal government as the controller, and you do not need to look any further than line 2.6, which says that this marketplace is whatever the ACA says this marketplace is, including amendments to come and regulations. And that means that whoever is governing the marketplace has got to follow the ACA and regulations and amendments into the future. So our organization does not support this. We do not support building this superstructure. We know that there's absolutely no consent. We've been told by the IT people that they are pre-populating the exchange with everybody's information. So we realize this is all about the IRS having access to all this information to enforce the compliance with the mandate by both employers and insurers. So we oppose what's being created, but we wanted you to understand, because people have said, well, what is the exchange? Well, see, it's not really the board. It's really this huge IT infrastructure that will be under control of this board that's going to meet quarterly, which I think is kind of amusing, and although I know it can meet more. But, you know, it's $50, $60 million and 70-some employees. So this is a really big deal, but the really big deal is to understand that it is the largest data sharing system in the history of this country, and it will be the largest data sharing system in the history of the state.
Thank you very much, Ms. Brace. Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I'm with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I want to state for the record that we are in support of Senate File 1, and we say thanks, Senator Lurie, for bringing it forward. I've heard a lot of concern that the way people purchase health insurance these days is going to change, and quite honestly, we're afraid it won't. Today we have too many people who buy health insurance with the best of intentions, and they find out years down the road if they receive a cancer diagnosis that maybe certain components of their treatment isn't covered. And I don't think we can say that that's because somebody intentionally sold them a policy that's not meeting their needs. But it's happening enough across our state and across our country that we know that the way we do business now needs to change. And so the center, the department, the state's taken on a pretty hefty challenge in looking to develop this health insurance exchange and come up with a new mechanism for ensuring that people can make better decisions, or at least more informed decisions, when they purchase health insurance. And if you're going to do that, we would recommend that you adopt the language in terms of how your board is composed, and also adopt the conflict of interest language to make sure you've got the right people around the table We're really looking out for what's best for consumers, today's consumers, and unfortunately tomorrow's patients in many cases. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for those comments. So, Senator Lurie, if you'd like to come back to the table, and maybe the director would like to join you. And I think now is the time to entertain amendments, if anyone has an amendment. Yes, and this is Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have an amendment. I just was wondering if the testifiers were going to take questions. We took a lot of testimony, and there was a lot of compelling testimony. I was wondering if we were able to ask the testifiers questions.
Well, normally we would do that. We are just a little pressed for time. So I think if there is a particular question you have, we can call that person back up to the table.
Okay. Well, I have a question for Mr. Schneeman.
Okay. Mr. Schneeman, would you like to come back? And you can just sit next to Senator Lurie. Okay. Proceed, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Schneeman, I was interested to hear your testimony about the regulation and interference in the compensation of the compensation of insurance agents. And I was wondering if you could apply what you said were your trepidations about what was in the bill to maybe a real-world scenario. I was going to try to have you help me paint a picture of exactly what you're concerned about, maybe in a more real-world sense.
Mr. Schneeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Much of the insurance, most of the health insurance sold in Minnesota today is facilitated one way or another by an independent broker of some sort, right? Independent agents are contracted with most of the carriers that operate in the state. And it's a fairly condensed marketplace, as many of you know. We've got four major health plans that are currently offering coverage. So an independent agent really will represent all of them. The current compensation structure has evolved over the years so that the compensation rate that's paid to the agent is really pretty much the same regardless of who the carrier is. In an exchange environment as being currently proposed, the exchange is suggesting that they want to capture all of that compensation and then somehow filter that and then pay it out to an agent separately. We don't think that's necessary at all to add another layer of overhead onto that arrangement there. The argument is that an agent would have a conflict of interest if there's a different level of compensation coming from one carrier or one type of plan to the next. But, for example, in the small group market in Minnesota since the early 1990s when Minnesota Care was first crafted, insurance agents were paid approximately $19 per employee per month, regardless of the plan or the carrier that was being enrolled at the time. So there really hasn't been a financial problem that we're trying to solve. So putting the exchange in the middle, we think, is just a problem. It adds costs. The other thing is that we don't – right now, we have different levels of obligations to each of the different carriers, right? They expect different things from us, right? I think that's kind of – any product has got different expectations of their distribution forces. We think that that's a reasonable thing to occur in a private marketplace. But for the exchange to capture all of that commission, and then when doing so, we become contracted with just a single entity then. We're really uncomfortable. Keep in mind that we always call ourselves independent agents representing a lot of products, and now suddenly we really are only representing one entity. We think that's risky. We think there's too much power in that single entity being the exchange, and we would prefer to leave well enough alone.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schneeman. I'm going to pass the gavel over to the Vice Chair, Chris, Senator Eaton, and I have the A8 amendment, if they pass out the amendment.
Would you like to present?
I'm just wondering where the amendment is. Okay, there it's going. Members, I've had some concern about who we're going to get to serve on this commission because of the conflict of interest provision. Obviously, there are some limits. And then with the compensation that Senator Lurie allows, it's a $55 a day plus expenses. And I think this is going to be a lot of work probably comparable to a part-time job, at least for a while. So if we want to, you know, get somebody who is retired from the industry, or somebody, a small business owner who might have to take time from their business, or a consumer who might have to take time off work to do this kind of job, I really think we should compensate them. So what my amendment does is it says that their compensation would literally be the same as the chair of the Metropolitan Airport Commission, which is about a quarter of the governor's salary. I mean, certainly the job that they're doing is as important as the Metropolitan Airport Commission. So I, what I've done is I've deleted the language on page 5, subdivision 12, and insert a new subdivision 12, which would require for that compensation.
Thank you, Senator. Is there any questions? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the compensation would be 25% of the $120,000 that the governor makes a year, and that would be for, and you talked about you envision a lot of time commitment, and I'm sure there will be a time commitment. But in the bill, it only requires one quarterly meeting a year. So under statute, they're only required to have four meetings. Now I understand there's some background and some other work that I'm sure will be done outside of those meetings. Is $30,000 a year for a minimum of four meetings a year seems a little bit high.
Madam Chair, walk
me through the rationale of that.
Senator Pappas?
I think that because of the structure they're required to put in the bill, that's the minimum required. But after I talked to Senator Lori and some other people, you know, they could have committees that are meeting quite often. They could be meeting weekly. They certainly could be meeting monthly. They could have a lot of research they have to do, especially in the beginning, the first year or so. I think we can always come back and revisit this if we think now, you know, it's a little bit more on autopilot. The staff is taking care of most things. But I do think this is a very huge responsibility. And in light of the conflict, you know, it's kind of the reason we pay judges money, because we don't want them to be vulnerable to outside influences. I mean, we do have the gift ban in place here. But I don't want people to be vulnerable to influence by outside influences, and I want us to be able to attract a wide variety of people, not just, you know, people who are independently wealthy and can kind of take time off or are retired or can take time to be on this board, but people who are working people or running a business who have to take significant amount of time to serve on this board.
Just to follow up, mm-hmm. Madam Chair, do we have any set of experiences or anything to look to in terms of the time commitment that it will take for these board members? Do we have any examples, or are we just kind of speculating and saying, well, we think $30,000 is appropriate for what we think it might be, or are we basing that on any kind of experience? And Senator Lori or Madam Chair?
Senator Lori?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, Senator Peterson. Senator Pappas did talk to me about this a little bit beforehand, and in many of the conversations that I've had with folks, you know, attracting really good expertise to this board has been one of the things that we just heard from many of the folks that were concerned about the makeup of the board. And, you know, I think that just looking at the work that's going to need to be done in the very near future, you know, I think I would consider this a friendly amendment. I think that some compensation, and certainly it's a fair point to discuss exactly what that level should be. We have experience with, like, the PUC is a board.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori, the PUC, they get paid a full-time salary of about $80,000. Yeah. And we did look at that as a potential model, but felt that that was maybe kind of too much. They're not going to be having semi-judicial hearings and have, you know, it was kind of a compromise. I would have preferred the PUC type of model, but felt that maybe this was a little bit more reasonable since we didn't really have any experience. So we looked at something incomparable. You know, the Met Council chair, the council members there do get some compensation. As I mentioned, the Metropolitan Airports Commission
chair does get compensated at about this level.
Madam Chair, just one more follow-up, if you will. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas. You talked about maybe coming back and revisiting it, and I actually respect what you're trying to do here. I think this is obviously an awesome responsibility, and I think we should do everything we can do to attract people that are qualified and want to put in the time commitment that's necessary to fulfill the duties. But you had mentioned an idea that I actually think is a good idea. Because we don't have any point of reference, and we are kind of just speculating on what the workload will be, I think it makes sense to take your suggestion and maybe do it in reverse, where you know we always have the authority to come back and then take a look at the body of work that is there and and adjust it accordingly, rather than doing it ahead of time and then potentially taking it away. People always like to get a raise rather than a reduction in salary. So I would just offer that suggestion as maybe a more prudent approach.
Madam Chair, I'm really interested in what the committee has to say about this, because this is like this is unproven territory we're going into. But I do think that the bulk of the work is going to be in this first year, and that maybe what we could look at, you know, certainly we could come back and revisit it next year, or what we could look at is putting a sunset on this compensation and reverting back to the per diem. That's one idea after a year or two. Or, you know, maybe just do more research on it in the next couple of weeks as it's going through the process and see if we can get more data from other states and find out what kind of compensation their boards are getting and what kind of work level. So I think that's the second is what I would prefer, is that we know that, and many of us are going to be on these other committees. I know I'm on Commerce, I'm on Finance. But I would really appreciate if the members would adopt this now, and then we'll go out and make sure we justify it before we get to the floor.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Pappas, I would like to support this. I do have some kind of hesitation about coming back and reviewing and proposing something different. The very essence of what you want to do is something that I really support. Oftentimes people ask why boards are not diverse. Why is that we don't have more women serving? And a lot of times it's because people cannot afford to serve. But if people apply knowing that, you know, they are taking time off and the expectation is that they receive this compensation, and then after they serve a year, we say, well, you don't have that compensation anymore. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard, I think, to kind of raise that expectation and then go back and say, we've changed our minds about that. So, you know, even if we have to amend your proposal later on to lower, I think it's better just to start with an amount and just stay with that. And maybe perhaps, you know, let them know that this is going to be reviewed in 2 years or something, just because of the nature of the work that they have to do. But we need to be careful with, you know, kind of raising the expectation, I think.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas, would you like to?
No.
Oh. Madam Chair and Senator Pappas. What would happen? Oh, I'm sorry. Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, what would happen if we changed the shall to may in your amendment?
Madam Chair, then I would wonder who would make the determination. I don't know. The governor, would the board itself, or I don't know, Senator Laurie?
Experience in the legislature setting our salaries, that's not a good idea.
Okay, if there, I guess,
is there
Madam
any other
Chair,
questions?
All right. Then I'd renew my motion for the A8.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
No.
Motion carries.
All right. Thank you. The gavel back. Are there any other
Madam
amendments?
Chair.
Senator Laurie.
Council had suggested a technical amendment getting to one of the issues that Senator Thompson raised about the broad exemption from 16A.1283. It's probably not going to help a great deal, but putting some bounds around it and really flesh it out and make sure that it's only applicable to the sections 2 and 3 that are the withholds, as I described. So a little bit of extra technical language to help put that in context has been drafted as the A15 amendment if members are interested in pursuing that. And again, it's not going to alleviate your core concern, I realize, but it could help just with the understanding that it has some bounds. And while you consider that, maybe one other little technical thing that came up during the...
Wait a minute. Let's take the A15 amendment.
Okay.
Does someone want to move that? Then Senator Dahl moves the... Unless Senator Thompson wants to do it. Senator Dahl moves the A15 amendment. Is there any more discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Lurie.
There was discussion about the may in the A14 amendment regarding the rulemaking process. They may use the expedited rulemaking process. And I considered trying to craft an amendment to make sure that that was actually required. And if you think about the structure of how it is, I don't think an amendment is required, just responding to that specifically. Right now, the incredibly expedited rulemaking that was in the Department of Health was the model that I described, is only available for 1 year. And that's clear in the amendment that we offered. And so then, you know, beyond that year, they may use expedited rulemaking. There's no other provision for any other type of rulemaking, any other type of, you know, if they want to do rulemaking, that's how they would have to do it. So, I mean, just for members to think about that one specific comment, because I wanted to, it certainly, what was described wasn't the intent. I mean, it was that the six-month expedited rulemaking would be the rulemaking process, and I did pursue a little bit whether an amendment was needed to get at that intent, and working with counsel, I believe that it's not, but certainly we're open to that as well.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lurie, I think that the language is correct, because not, you know, when the rule process is just not an absolute process, you know, that the department is going to have to determine. So, and how that determination is made is kind of based on what is needed. And so I think the word may is the correct one. Shall implies that they should go into the rule process regardless. And I think that, you know, the conversations we have had during the last 2 years were really with regard to that, you know, that I don't think we should impose. The rule may or may not apply, and it all depends of how, you know, it all evolves. So I feel very comfortable with the word may.
Okay. Are there any other amendments? Okay. Is there any discussion, any other questions of Senator Lurie, any of the witnesses, any concerns, debates? Senator Eaton.
I would like to move the amendment as
move the bill as amended.
One, as amended by A14. Thank you.
Okay. The motion has been made. Yes.
And 15
minutes. Oh. Okay. I think you can just say move Senate File 1 as amended.
As amended.
And it covers all the amendments.
Thank you.
All right. You heard the motion, Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, I'd request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Then, at that point, the clerk will take the roll. When we finish discussion, Senator Peterson?
No. Senator Thompson.
Oh, Senator Thompson. I'm sorry.
No problem. My head. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think obviously we have not had a long time to look at this legislation, and it is very broad and sweeping and grants a lot of power.
You're probably on three more committees that are going to hear it.
I'm aware of that. I think for me the hesitation I have is the absolute discretion that this board has. And again, I pointed out earlier that it's not an agency of government. We don't have the kind of legislative oversight. It in effect has taxing authority as a practical. I mean, I realize we can say it isn't taxing authority. And Senator Lurie, I appreciate your amendment that reduced a little bit the breadth of that provision. But it just seems to me that we're creating a board, people on it that aren't going to have representatives from many of the stakeholders in this because they're aced out by this conflict provision and is going to be able to have a tremendous amount of power and authority over our healthcare system and how it's delivered. And, you know, the rulemaking changes. I mean, for the first year, it's just basically the people can comment, and then their comments are ignored, and the rule is posted. Kind of reminds me of the old Legal Eagles movie where Robert Redford said, "We'll conduct a fair trial and then convict you." And it seems to be kind of the same way there. So I guess what I think the people of Minnesota need to understand here is that this is an incredible amount of authority and discretion and money being put into the hands of people that are not accountable to the legislature other than basically to file an annual report. And I would strongly encourage members to vote against it in its current form.
Thank you. Any other comments from members? Senator Hall.
Yes, Madam Chair. I would agree with what's his name over there?
Thompson.
Our Senator Thompson. You know, I may have been gone first part of this week, but it feels like this has come in and bang, we're just hitting the, you know, something that I think you said, 40 years we haven't had legislation like this. And so it takes some time to digest it. I think it takes time to look at it. And then I see the stakeholders that are really in conflict with it. And I wonder if we just need to wait on this thing, table it. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you can move to table it now, but if I could, I'd table it. And give it some time, and maybe, you know, Senator Laurie, I really appreciate, you know, that what you're trying to do here, and I think we need a Minnesota exchange in that sense. And but if we can take our time at it instead of rushing it, I think we're better apt. If not, I'll be voting no against it.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I just would like to say that this has been going on for a long time. I think this has been going on for over 2 years, and it does seem very quick at this point, but there is a deadline, a federal deadline. And I think that I, for one, would not like to see us simply adopt a federal exchange. And I think if we don't meet our deadline, that's probably what would happen. And I appreciate the work that's been going on for the last 2 years in this regard. And thank you for listening to everybody. And I just think that it's time that we just have to take action on this.
Thank you. Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Senator Scalzi and with Senator Hall's comment about it feeling like we're rushing it. I know that last year, as we knew that this law and that this exchange was going to have to take effect, you know, I sat all year long in the Health and Human Service Committee, and we never took any action. I know that there was work that was being done outside of the legislature, but as we were supposed to start to talk about an exchange bill and what we should do and how we should do it, we had opportunities last year to do it, and we didn't do it. And so now the time has come. I think Senator Laurie has done a good job, and he seems to be open-minded enough and working with, even on the fly today, working with stakeholders to try to make the bill the best that it can. We have six other stops that this bill has to make before it hits the Senate floor, and the same on the House side. So I think we do have enough time in order to get this bill into shape that at least it will be a good Minnesota exchange. And I think that now is the time for us to kind of get this train rolling and start today by voting yes for the bill as amended, and then continue to have this thoughtful discussion as we do in the legislature moving forward.
Discussion. Senator Hosley.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is it Hosley or Hosley?
Housley.
Housley.
Housley, okay. Yeah. I'm just wondering, what is the next stop? Is it Commerce, and what is the date for that?
Oh, that's thank you for reminding me that, because the motion has to include refer to Judiciary Committee. They're going to hear the data practices section, and then I think after that, maybe it goes to Commerce, and then it's going to go to Taxes. And then it's going to go to finance, and it'll be heard in several divisions, at least one.
Policy first.
Yeah. Policy?
Well, I mean, it needs to – I mean, I can rattle off the committees that it needs to go to. It's going to go to judiciary – Madam Chair.
Yes, please, Senator.
It's going to go to judiciary from here. Mm-hmm. There are several other stops, but it does seem to be a moving target in which order we take it. The plan today is to hear it in judiciary next week. Get it, you know, providing it passes, it would be referred from there to Commerce, from Commerce to Health Policy. And again, this is just, you know, early plans. Today the motion is going to be to move to judiciary. Nothing is certain, but all these committees will be hearing it. So HHS policy, it will need a hearing in taxes to come to discuss some of the issues brought up by Thompson, Senator Thompson. It'll have to go to finance. It'll have to go to at least the HHS finance division, and possibly another division or two are being discussed.
Madam Chair?
Senator Eden.
Within the finance division.
Right. Just before you do that, are there any other comments or questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm concerned about the speed of the bill and the way it's going. I'm concerned about the concerns of the people that came in that have expertise in the area of health care, and the statements that were made regarding the rulemaking and other points within there, and I think that we're moving this bill as much as we'd like to say we should have moved it 2 years ago. I think it's moving way too fast, and I guess I will not be supporting the bill at this point.
Okay. Senator Eaton, to restate your motion.
I'd like to move Senate File 1 as amended and have it referred to judiciary.
Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 1 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Pappas?
Yes.
Eaton?
Yes.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Dahl?
Yes.
Goodwin? Hayden?
Yes.
Housley?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Peterson?
No.
Scalzi?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Torres Ray?
Yes.
On a vote 7-5, the motion does prevail. The bill is passed and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. There being no more business before the committee is adjourned, and see you all next week.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.